Good morning, everyone. It's afternoon where I am on the other side of the continent. This is the first time that I have, I think, it's the first time I've ever given Dharma talk across this distance. Oops, I'm just wanting to switch so I can see all of you. So sorry about the backlighting. This is the best I could do. I am at my brother's home so that I can visit my very elderly dad who we just took on a beautiful ride through the countryside. This is very beautiful countryside. If you've ever heard of the Amish people, or the Mennonite people who settled here from Germany, fleeing religious persecution, probably a couple of hundred years ago. So they're very, very beautiful old stone farmhouses and beautiful old barns and farmers farming still with draft horses and mules sometimes. And you see sometimes the horse-drawn carriages and buggies in some parts of this area, and even the others, it's quite lovely. So my dad really enjoyed his ride through the country, and it was nice to be able to do that for him because it may be his last. So just want to kind of let you know where I'm speaking from and how lovely it is to see all of you, wherever you are scattered about, scattered about our BC region and beyond. So we've been looking at life koans, haven't we, over the past couple of weeks in this practice intensive. And for me, they sort of boil down to that fundamental koan of self and world. You know, how do we, in our human imperfection and fallibility and blundering and confusion, find the wherewithal to bring forward our lives in each moment in the world, just as we are, just as the world is, with an open heart and a supple mind. To me, it kind of boils down to that. In fact, that's why I think brought me to practice is that question, rather than, oh, I've got to get enlightened. It's like, how can I live in this world? So we've looked at these questions through the lenses of some koans, some of the traditional koans, the one about Dongshan and Shanshan crossing the rushing mountain river, the place of no mistakes. And Michael brought us the story of Manjushri, who could not manage to raise the young woman out of samadhi when the bodhisattva of delusive wisdom could. And also the koan about how do you leap from a 100-foot pole? How do you risk everything or nothing? And if you missed those, they're posted on the website. So today, I'm going to turn that koan kaleidoscope another notch to look at how we separate ourselves from ourselves. And I'm going to tell you a story from case 35 of the Gateless Barrier, or Mumonkan Koan collection. The case itself in the Mumonkan is very short. It just goes like this. The woman, Qian, and her spirit were separated. Which was the true Qian? That's it. That's the koan. So a woman who collected these stories, these dialogues, assumed that his readers would know the old folktale of Qian, that from early China, the Tang Dynasty or earlier. Folktales are unusual in the koan literature, but there are some. And they're folk tales are folk tales because their stories have a kind of universality often, and that we can all connect to them. So because this is Mother's Day, this is a family story. This is a family story. Because it's Mother's Day, I've changed the character of the father to a mother, which is probably not historically accurate, because the father would have had the patriarchal authority in this story. But I think, as we know, throughout patriarchal history, strong women have had their ways of making their influence felt. So let's imagine that this Chinese mother had a role in this story, even though it doesn't appear in the tradition. So here's how the story goes. Long ago in China, there was a woman named Chang Qian who had a beautiful daughter named Qian. As a child, the girl played every day with her cousin, who was, of course, handsome, a handsome boy named Wang Chao. One day, the mother jokingly said to her nephew, when you grow up, you'll marry Qian. And so both children took her very seriously and believed that they were betrothed, that they would marry. However, when Qian grew up into a lovely young woman, a man of wealth and rank asked for her hand in marriage, and her parents agreed for all those reasons that was the way, and had been the way, has been the way in many cultures and many times. So Qian was dismayed, very upset. And her cousin, Wang Chao, was so angry, he decided to leave home. The next day, without telling anyone, he packed his bags, and at nightfall, he set out in his boat down the river that flowed past their town. Just as he reached the outskirts of town, he heard a voice calling him. It was Qian. Delighted, he rowed to the bank, and she jumped in. They traveled a very long way until they came to a distant province where they settled and lived for 6 years. They had two children and they were quite happy, but Qian often missed her parents and wished to see them again. So she finally convinced Wang Chao to take them back for a visit. When they arrived, Wang Chao went to the house first, not sure how he would be received. But his aunt came to the door and welcomed him warmly, saying, I've wondered what happened to you. Have you been well? Wang Chao replied, I don't deserve your kind words. I've come to beg your forgiveness. And Chang Qian, the mother, seemed a little confused. What do you mean? I thought you might still be angry with me for taking Qian away. We've been living in Chu province all these years. Qian? The mother said, seemingly dumbfounded. Yes, your daughter. The nephew was beginning to wonder if the old woman had lost her mind. Then she said, what are you talking about? My daughter has been right here, sick in bed, ever since you went away these 6 years. Now Wang Chao was starting to get frustrated. Please don't mock us, he said. Your daughter has been my wife for 6 years. We have two children and have returned to seek your forgiveness. The two stared at each other. The mother motioned for her nephew to come inside the house. In an inner room lay Qian, pale and thin, still beautiful. Her mother said, she cannot speak, but she can hear and understand. And then she turned to her daughter and said jokingly, Chao wants you. Chao tells me you ran away with him and you two have children. The young woman smiled but said nothing. Wang Chao then said to his aunt, come back with me to the river. I see this woman, but your daughter Qian is in my boat at this moment. They arrived at the boat and there was Qian. She bowed to her mother and asked her forgiveness. The mother replied, if you are really my daughter, I have nothing but love for you. But I don't understand this. Please come up to the house. So they turned back towards the house. And when they had almost reached the house, they saw the sick and pale Qian coming to meet them, smiling with joy. And as the two young women met, they merged into one with no trace of illness or sorrow. The mother said to Wang Chao, "Ever since you left, she lay like that in a stupor. Now I know that her spirit had left her." And then Qian herself said, "I was never aware that I was at home. That day I saw Wang Chao go off angry. That night I thought I dreamed I ran after his boat. Now I'm not sure which was the real me, the one that ran away or the one that stayed home." So we could tell countless versions of this story, couldn't we? Change the time, change the place, the gender or the race. Maybe the girl knew inside that she was a boy, or the boy knew he was a girl. Maybe the parents wanted the daughter or the son to be a doctor or a lawyer, and they wanted to be a dancer or a writer or a sculptor or a Zen monk. And maybe their beloved was someone of a different color or race or religion. In such stories, whether it's a matter of conforming to expectations or of leave-taking, sometimes self-exile, to make a different choice, there's a splitting of the self. There are so many ways we become separated from ourself. As little children, naturally expressing ourselves, we quickly learn what is acceptable and what is unacceptable to those upon whom we are completely dependent for our physical and emotional needs, right? Initially our parents or our primary caregivers, but then extending to our social surroundings, our schoolmates, our teachers. We learn to shape our behavior to win approval and to avoid disapproval. We learn what makes others uncomfortable. It may be our anger, our sadness, or it might be our exuberance, our intelligence, or our slow-wittedness, our beauty, or our plainness. In some families, you're scorned if you're smart. In some families, you're scorned if you're not. It may be the way we express our gender or our sexuality. It depends so much on the conditioning, of our, you know, generations of ancestors, our family culture, our larger culture, and how those around us react to us. But we don't know that when we're small, right? We just take our family culture as a given. It's what's around us every day, and so we adapt if we're able. And so often that adaptation involves cutting off a part of ourselves, splitting ourselves into some part remaining hidden. If we get mixed messages, or if it seems like there's nothing we can do to win their approval, we get confused. We may act out our frustration, or we may just shut right down. Those expressions of ourself that are not acceptable go underground into the shadows of our psyche. They become our ghost selves, like the ghostly Qian in her bed, in her room. A sure sign that one of our ghost selves is stirring is when we're really bothered by that quality that we hid manifesting in someone else. If you're really annoyed by people who take center stage and seem to hog all the attention in a social situation, you might ask yourself if there's a ghostly self in you that yearns for a little more of that attention, not center stage, but a little more, right? You know? And yet we think, oh no, I'm not like that. But aren't we all entitled simply to take our place in the world? To use the expression our teacher Norman Fisher uses in his book, taking our places, you know, becoming a fully adult human being in the world. And this is what he maintains we must do to truly grow up and mature. So many forces continue to shape us as we come through our childhood, our adolescence, our early adulthood. That tell us who we should or shouldn't be in ways that may or may not conflict with what we learned in our families. But to truly grow up, we have to take our place within the particularities of our family and cultural karmic drama. We have to see our lives as part of a vast network of cause and effect that we call the human condition. And if we can really do this, then our hearts begin to open and we can feel a kind of compassion for ourselves and for others in our human predicament. We could also tell a story, such a story as this, about each turning point in our lives. One for each time we left rather than stayed, or stayed rather than left. A home, a relationship, a career. For every one of those turning points, there's a self that has lived this life and another possible self we would have been if we'd taken the other turn, right? Which is our true self. Sometimes we wonder, particularly when we're dissatisfied with this life right here and now. Well, shouldn't I be doing, or shouldn't I have done, right? You know, we wrestle with those questions. Those wonderings arise for all of us at times, I think, when we're in states of frustration or self-pity or times of transition. But when we look at our lives with our Dharma eye of wisdom and compassion, we see that to have taken a different path, we would have had to have had a different family, different schooling, a different socio-cultural environment at a different time in history. We would have been a different person. You know, this is the person we are right now with this particular history. And with our Dharma eye, we see our life in this vast matrix of being and interconnection. And when we can do that, we can let go. We can let go a little bit of our fear and our judgments and live the beautiful, terrible details of our lives within boundlessness. Are at the same time boundless. When our deep yearnings of our life are thwarted or suppressed by external forces that give us no sense of choice or agency, our ghost self can go into a state of suspended animation, sort of frozen, like Qian's, sometimes for years, sometimes for our whole lives. This story is included as one of the stories in the collection called The Hidden Lamp, Stories from 25 Centuries of Awakened Women, with commentary by, there are 100 stories and 100 commentaries by contemporary women Buddhist teachers. And Ajahn Linda Ruth Kutz, the former abbess of San Francisco Zen Center, or maybe she's abiding abbess now, was the one who wrote the commentary on this story. This is what she said. Our ghost selves have a way of leaking out through the cracks in our armor. When resentment and bitterness ferment within us, they can spill out when an interaction opens an earlier wound. Sometimes just a little scratch can open up a poisonous abscess of long-held anger. And that's certainly true, and probably many of us can verify that experience. But also sometimes, despite our fear, despite our contraction, something opens us up. Something just shifts, opens. We connect with the world around us in surprisingly loving and joyous ways. And we're just spontaneously ourselves. Maybe you know what that feels like too. Those healing connections invite our ghost selves out to play with the natural world, with plants and animals, and sometimes even with one person who sees and accepts us. Our practice, our Dharma practice, offers us the possibility of cultivating a mind spacious enough to include the totality, the complexity of our lives, just as they are. Sitting in stillness, paying attention to your moment-to-moment experience in Zazen and in daily life, with patience and kindness towards whatever arises, not grabbing on, not pushing away. Sadness, restlessness, desire, anger, despair, deep peace. You begin to experience that boundlessness of being. Your old frayed stiff armor loosens a little bit or drops right away, like the cast off husk of a cicada. That's an image often used in Japanese poetry. That dropping away, and when Dogen says mind and body drop away, he uses the word datsuraku, drop away, and it's like drop, that shedding of the snake skin, shedding of the cicada's shell. And for a few moments, we can breathe freely, unencumbered. And then sometimes the armor snaps back. But we know what it feels like for even those few minutes to be unencumbered. Which is the real you? The armored or the dropping away? So let's look at what Wu Men said in his commentary on this question in the koan. This is commentary to the koan. Wu Men says, if you realize the truth, then you'll know that emerging from one husk and entering another is like a traveler putting up at an inn. If this is still not clear, don't rush about recklessly. When you suddenly separate into earth, water, fire, and air, you'll be like a crab dropped into boiling water, struggling with your seven hands and eight legs. Don't say I never warned you. So he doesn't answer this question, which one is the true Qian? He doesn't give us the answer. That's because it's an either or question, right? He says, if you don't understand the answer, if you understand the answer, you will also understand that emerging from one husk and entering another is like a traveler stopping at one inn after another. In other words, the journey continues. This sounds like a classic description of reincarnation, but I think of the soul leaving one body and entering another, but I think that interpretation is too small, too narrow. I think it's about our whole lives, the expansion and contraction in our lives. One of the earliest Japanese Zen masters to teach in the West, Nyogen Senzaki, also urges us to take a wider view of this commentary from Wu Men. He says that what Wu Men means is that the shell, the temporary manifestation of our life, cannot particularize or pin down what he calls the universal body or eternal traveler, or what we could call the true self or big mind or Buddha nature. He says, we pass from one shell to another, not just with each lifetime, but with each moment. We are continuously coming into being and passing out of being, like waves on the ocean, which is a metaphor often used in Zen texts. And Woman says, if this is still not clear, don't rush about recklessly, but settle deeply into your practice of paying attention, waking up to this life just as it is, meeting each moment fully, then letting it go. And if we don't, he warns us, fair warning, he says, when the time comes for us to let go of this body, of this life, we will struggle like a crab dropped into boiling water. And isn't it true that there are people who seem to face their death with composure and ease, and others who struggle against it to their last breath? What is it that they get or don't get? How will each of us say goodbye to the world with grace when our time comes? Mumon still hasn't answered the question, but he offers us this verse. Of course, all these koans have a verse as part of the commentary. This is the verse. The moon and the clouds are the same. Mountains and valleys are different. All are blessed. All are blessed. Is this one? Is this two? So let's imagine that scene, looking out over a river valley with mountains in the background and a full moon shining down over everything, with scattered clouds passing across the moon, now partially covering it, then revealing it again. This is the pure light of awareness shining on our lives. Sometimes it's obscured by our fears and our confusions, our resentments, our avoidances, but they shift, inevitably they shift. And we can see the landscape of our life again, just as it is. In this light of awareness, our most hidden places and our most exposed are illuminated. I think this poem is a beautiful metaphor. Let me read it again. The moon and the clouds are the same. Mountains and valleys are different. All are blessed. All are blessed. Is this one? Is this two? I think it's a beautiful metaphor for what Dogen calls undivided activity. Dogen says, know that there are innumerable beings in yourself. Where there is birth, there is death. Both the entire earth and the entire sky appear in birth as well as in death. However, it is not that one and the same entire earth and sky are fully manifested in birth and in death. Although not one, not different. Although not different, not the same. Although not the same, not many. There's some classic Dogen language. Can we live in the reality of both oneness and differentness, differentiation? Are you your Facebook profile? Are you your professional identity? Your role as a parent, a spouse, a son, or a daughter? Are you your gender, your sexuality, your race, your ethnicity? All that and more? Is there an identity that was once central to you that no longer is? Is there an identity you have claimed that has revealed a self you'd hidden? Is there some path not yet taken that you still yearn to follow? There are some koans for you. Before I close, though, I want to go back to the story of our koan. It seems to me it's not only about the reconciliation of the split self, but of parent and child, parent and adult child. Remember, the mother or the father of the original goes to see the woman waiting in the boat, and she says, if you really are my daughter, I have nothing but love for you. After all those years of fear and estrangement, I think, you know, we've probably, many of us observed how both parents and children can remain stuck in mutual distrust and judgment, blind to the yearning for connection that lies deep in the heart, even after many years, that yearning of our ghost selves. So this story reminded me of another story I heard last year at the Vancouver Writers Festival. It was a story by an Inuit woman writer, and I'm sorry I didn't write her name down. And the name of her book is Fatty Legs, Fatty Legs, and I'm going to read you this, what I wrote after hearing her. It's a young reader's story for children or young readers, but she read her story in her presentation for the Writers Festival. So this is what I wrote after I listened to it. An Inuit woman now in her 70s reads from the book she wrote, telling the story of her girlhood. I listen. She lived on an island in the Arctic Ocean, yearned to learn to read, went willingly by boat and train against her mother's wishes, unlike the children who were dragged away by the RCMP to a school that looked and felt like a prison with nuns as guards. She called the mean one Raven, the kind one Swan. They sheared off her long black braids. She joined the row of weeping, shamed girls. They forbade her to speak her language, gave her a foreign name, Margaret, my own mother's name. They gave her red knee-high socks, the name Fatty Legs. On the day when the girls were allowed to send a radio message to their parents, she was handed a slip of paper with a scripted message to read. She refused. Silence, the weapon of the silenced. After 2 years away, she returned in alien clothes and cropped hair, ran from the boat to her mother, now as tall as she. "Not my girl," her mother recoiled. Father stepped forward, wrapped her in his parka. She sobbed until she felt her mother's soft touch stroking her hair. Hearing her tell her story, I remembered my younger self, away so long, home for a visit, my mother saying, "I feel like I don't even have any kids." And decades later, her grievances forgotten, along with much of her past, her hand on my hair. "How did you get so silver?" We may or may not receive in our lifetime the gift of such a reconciliation with a mother or a father. But this koan is about how we can reconcile the rejecting parent and the rejected child in our own hearts and minds, so that we can offer our wholeness to the world unobstructed, embracing the complexity of our lives as they continue to unfold. Not one, not two. One self, many selves. If there were no contours, no particularity to our life, how could we see its true vastness? How wondrous, how blessed. So I thank you all for joining me across the great distance through the ether and magic of Zoom. Be well, everyone. Thank you. Let's chant. Mm-hmm.